Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is glass mixed media artist Lina Dolph. Her work includes abstracts, landscapes, and geometrics. She has worked professionally in this medium for about 15 years. Intertwined with her artwork, which began in her childhood, has been the world of horses and riding. Dolph is a member of the Ithaca Art Trail, as well as Handwork Gallery and the Salmon Gallery in Trumansburg. Her glasswork has been in many exhibits and shows, including the Handwork Cooperative Gallery, State of the Art, CNY in Bloom in Syracuse, and the Corners Gallery in Ithaca. And welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here. You said that your earliest memory is of drawing trees and riding horses. To tell us a little bit about that, and it seems like it's whatever your life developed into, that was the beginning of this journey.
Well, I started drawing trees and horses when I was about 3 years old. Horses came first. I mean, because I was just infatuated with the animal. And trees, I just kind of would just sit there and doodle. I'm a big doodler. I really, I still am. I can't stop. But I'm not exactly sure what to say about it. It's just, that's what I did. I didn't spend a lot of time with other people. So I would just sit and draw. And I mean, I once sat down when I was in fourth grade and did a mural that was the length, it was probably an 8 foot long, 4 foot tall mural.
Wow.
Of the animals in Africa, just because I had the measles or something and I couldn't go anywhere. And I had to do something. I don't do idle very well.
Yeah. Oh, and art was, what a great focus. Now you say that in sixth grade you learned to ride. And you said something really intriguing in your notes. You said, I had been a horse in my own body for so long that it, meaning riding, came easily for you. Tell us about that. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, little girls, you see them pretend, well, you don't so much anymore, but in the old days, you know, from watching cowboys and Indian movies, little girls became horses. You know, you'd see all these little girls running around and winning, and I don't see it at all anymore. But I became a horse. I thought of myself as a horse. And as I learned to ride, I thought of myself as not, I was the horse and the rider when I would, you know, gallop around, and it didn't exactly make me a lot of friends.
So did you feel like the power of the horse? And
oh yeah,
when I think
all
about riding horses, I rode horses as a kid too, and I remember the feeling of freedom.
It's freedom. It's power. It's being in control, where in most of your life you're not.
Yeah.
It was really liberating, and as a kid, of course, I didn't think of those things. It was more just, here I am. You know, I was out in a field with a pony and galloping around and getting dumped and having a wonderful time.
You also said that art classes were the only thing that you excelled in your early academic years. So tell us about that.
Well, I was a fairly miserable student.
Yeah, but what was it about art, and were you encouraged at all?
Well, my mother was the supervisor for the art department at Ithaca Public Schools, which didn't necessarily help. She was encouraging in the sense that she would say, that's pretty good, you know. But the reality was that she didn't want any of her children to get towards art as a career. So she'd kind of like keep it under wraps a bit. Encouragement. My art teacher was wonderful. It was Mrs. Thomas, and she was old then, and she's dead now. But she'd put her arm around me and just say, "This is great,"
wow.
You know. So, and she put me in all the art shows, and they had these little art shows at the end of the school year, where everybody would get to display their work, and I'd get little ribbons next to mine. You know, it was great. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
And That was encouraging. As far as anything, you know, to be known as the little artist was kind of alienating in some ways. And even at that age, you know, you're sort of separated from.
Yeah, especially if you're getting praise for it, right?
Right, yeah, and, you know, singled out. And academically, I was so miserable that, you know, how could there be, it was a dichotomy. How could there be art on one side that was so good and like academics that were so horrendous?
So you must have found art as a way to express some of the stuff that you couldn't express or do academically, right?
I mean,
there was your way of getting in touch with yourself, it seems to me.
Yeah.
And then do you think the adults around you realize that?
No. Absolutely not. Well, I went to Cayuga Heights School. And in those days, Cayuga Heights School was 95% professors' kids.
Mm.
And they had already learned how to read by the time they got to kindergarten. They knew mathematics. They knew, you know. And I walked in there, and I didn't have a clue. And I stayed that way. You get ignored after a while. First you get embarrassed, and then you get ignored, and then you stay embarrassed and ignored. So it wasn't a pleasant experience right from the get-go, the first day.
Yeah.
So I'd go out on the playground and they'd turn us loose and I'd go out and gallop around and pretend I was, Winnie and paw the ground and really put myself into a, pickle.
Well, I think that's interesting that you kept with these things that you found a passion for, right? Art and horses.
Yeah.
It's amazing. You never gave them up. You didn't try to fit in some way by giving them up.
And you give up on that after a while.
the people who really have a passion do. Some people get defeated, though, don't you?
Well, I can certainly see how and why, and because it is, to go through, your childhood with few friends. I finally found another person in sixth grade who kind of did. She was a professor's kid, and in fact, her father was the dean of the English department. And she did the same thing. And different. She didn't pursue horses the way I did, but she pursued academics. But she would whinny and do all that stuff. She started riding long, long before I did, though.
Yeah, but you eventually became a horse trainer. And let's get to this part, too, that you ended up buying an old horse farm and fixing it up. And you said you started doing barn art. Now tell me what that meant.
When I bought the property, I kind of looked it over and I just saw the whole thing and thought it might be really interesting if I could turn the entire piece of property into a piece of artwork. I mean, it wasn't as intellectual as that, but I would, I started off just by, picking up an old piece of plywood and putting paint on it, mostly geometric quilt type designs.
Mm-hmm.
And Escher-esque kind of, sort of going in and out. And I put them on the barn. And I don't know if they look good to anybody else, but I loved them, And it was just sort of my way of saying, okay, there's something more here than just horses. And making it look better. I mean, the place was a mess when I moved in.
Yeah. But you got back in touch with your art after many, many years of mainly being a horse trainer. I find that very interesting. Now, you were eventually diagnosed with and had to go through these long bouts of cancer.
Uh-huh.
And that changed your life as well. Tell us about that, because you eventually couldn't ride horses and you couldn't do a lot of physical work, and you turned back to art.
Yeah. Well, there was not much else there. I don't mean that, but I mean, I do in some ways. During the times when I was recovering from surgeries, I had a lot of them because it seemed like one led to another and the mistakes led to another mistake.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a big mess. It went on for years. And there were long periods of recovery. And since I don't sit well, I would, just try to find ways to keep myself entertained. And then the entertainment turned into more of an obsession than anything else. I didn't want to leave my work. I didn't want to leave the artwork. When it came back to getting fit again, of course, that's a fairly difficult thing to do, especially as you age, to get to where you're riding fit. I mean, riding horses, even though, excuse me, most people look at people who ride as, the horse does all the work. Well, it's nonsense.
That is nonsense.
The fittest people in the world are jockeys.
Yeah. I mean, it takes a lot of muscles.
You fine-tune every one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I always say that the true athlete is one who can isolate all muscle groups and work them independently of one another. So to get back there again, well, each time it got chipped away, but, you know, I would get as close as I could.
Yeah.
But it was harder because I wanted to finish that project that I was working on.
And you were working in different mediums at this point,
yeah,
too, right?
I was working with metal and...
With metal and fabric and
yeah,
stone and stuff
things.
Like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. To tell us what you were creating. What was it? Was it
not
abstract?
Much.
But you were obsessed with it, though.
I was.
And you completed projects,
I was just
right?
Sort of... Oh, I completed everything. But it's not... I didn't have, like... Okay, an example here. Is this kid who had ridden with me for years, and I loved this kid. I didn't at the beginning, but we became really close friends. She gave me her shoes that she had, like, her boots, actually, that had totally been distorted and destroyed. And she was leaving town. She was going off to college. So I took the boots and I put them in a box with rails, like they were going into a jail.
Oh.
And put, you know, stuff on the, like, I can't remember, a checkerboard thing on the bottom. And so, yeah, and this was like a monument for her, you know, her departure. On it, I said, here in body but not in soul, spelled soul, S-O-L-E.
Uh-huh.
So, I would do things like that. I'd just get this idea that, you know, okay, make something for someone. It was always, you know, for someone. I didn't really have the presence of mind to say, okay, this is for me. This is, you know, it was all, you know, I always had to direct it. And for years and years, that was that way. I had to, like, okay, I'm making this one for this person. Even if they never got it, you know.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
you
it
just
was.
Had somebody in mind.
I had to have somebody but other than myself to justify it sort of in mind. Because,
wow.
You know, there was not going to be any money involved. It was just, you know, I had to justify it.
So it seems to me you went back into art during this huge cancer experience in order to get out emotions again, right?
Right.
I mean,
yeah,
just like
yeah.
you did as a child. Did you feel like you were coming full circle?
No. Well, maybe to a certain degree, but mostly I was trying to avoid the terror of having cancer.
Yeah,
because I was sure that, you know, I had a kid, and, you know, and she was in fourth grade, and I thought, oh my God, you know, I can't allow myself to leave her, you know. So find ways to, like, make yourself happy again, or at least a little bit thrilled, so that you know, keep more of a positive energy going,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
to stay alive.
Yeah,
you know,
keep
even
your
though
spirits up.
There was no, I mean, that was all in my head in a lot of ways. This wasn't going to kill me. You know, it was, well, it could have, I suppose, but it wasn't the kind of cancer that's aggressive and stuff.
Yeah.
It was just...
But you were in pain, right? You,
oh,
you
I
was describe
a
mess. You were in
well,
terrible pain. I'm surprised you could do art.
Well, I just... working through pain is something I'm really good at, because I still am in pain, and I still work my way through it. It's getting harder, but it's, you know, it's not like I'm a he person or anything, you know, but I just do make sure that I... try to put that aside and just go with it, unless it's too intensive, and then
yeah.
I just go to bed.
Do you work out what you're going to create, or does it just happen organically?
Well, I used to just, you know, try to figure out, like, little, you know, if it's a three-dimensional piece, you have to mess with that a little bit to make sure that it's going to stand up. But now with glass, I make a complete drawing of whatever I'm going to do. You have to have a pattern.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it doesn't fit together.
If you're just joining us, my guest is mixed media glass artist Lynna Dolph. We're talking about her work and her long road back to art from a long career as a horse trainer. Now, I did want to bring that up. In 2003 is when you discovered glass.
Right.
You said it was a rebirth. And tell us how you discovered it.
Well, I had a friend who... was a young student of mine. She started with me when she was 11. And she said, I think, you know, she watched me, you know, progress through using all these different mediums. You know, she said, well, let me just take you down to this place. My sister did it. And she, you know, took me down. And I said, my God.
What was this place?
Cervantes. I started going through the glass and just fell in love with the glass itself, just holding it up into the light and seeing what different glass did in different lights and different the textures, the colors. And my favorite was this stuff called Blanco. And I bought him out.
Really?
I got it all.
So tell us about it. This glass comes in different forms. Is it like found items?
No, it comes in sheets. You can get it in West Virginia. The company is falling apart. It's, you know, as most glass companies are right now, or many of them. And it's very disorganized. And the only way you can get it is to go there, unless you find scraps. Mm-hmm. And I went through all my scraps in a hurry. And I'm going this summer, actually, in June.
So you take these sheets of glass, so tell us how you create a sculpture. I mean, a lot of people know about stained glass. That seems, but how do you create a sculpture? You smash the glass into pieces, or
no,
how do you do that?
I use a cutter. You know, I score the glass, I cut the glass, and you know, it's all by design because I have it in front of me. Some of the sculptural pieces, since I don't really know how to put that together that well, I have to kind of fudge it a little bit. So I'll take one, let's say I make a cube, and then I have a corresponding cube which may not be the same size. I'll have to find a way through the solder to put that together on top with that, and then put something on that, and then that. And it just, that's never figured out beforehand. The flat work, of course, is.
Yeah, yeah. Do you paint your own glass, or do you buy colored glass?
No, I don't like painted glass. It's some of it's a flash glass, which is a clear glass with the glass flashed on top with heat, and others is it's all the way through. And most of the glass I use, I don't use this stuff called spectrum glass. I don't use the less expensive glass because I find that you can't do. I also do a thing where I do an overlay, and you can't do it because the heat cracks the glass, and you know you're done with this piece, and you're doing the overlay as the last thing, and all of a sudden you hear this, and it cracks all the way through the thing, and you go, okay, that's the end of that. I just spent 200 hours on this piece, and it's done.
Oh wow!
You know, so I buy really good European glass. Uh-huh. And I find it, people have it. You know, people have it. They've stopped doing the work. I find them, they find me, and I get it.
Wow, that is amazing. So what do you think it is about glass that took your soul so by a grip of some sort?
I don't,
sort?
You know, it's,
you,
it's
you
the
say
weirdest,
rebirth about
it's
it. It's amazing.
It's the weirdest thing because I pick up a piece of glass and I'll hold it up and look at it in this strange feeling comes over me where it doesn't happen as much as it used to, but where it's like, I've got to use, or I just have to look at it. And I mean, some big sheets I've had where you'll see this thing go through it, and there's detail, there's texture, there are all these lines and beauty and you know, what do I do with it? I don't know, but you try to find a way to put that in where you don't disrupt that beautiful part of it, you know,
wow.
Because you don't want it to lose its own integrity. It's got to be there.
Yeah. So you actually became mesmerized by glass.
Oh, I did.
By glass.
Yeah,
absolutely. It's
yeah.
some kind of a magical formula that your soul connected with,
yeah,
right?
I have no idea where it came from. I mean, when I was a kid, I used to go to church, and I'd look at the windows. God knows I didn't listen to anything else in there. And, you know, a religious kind of. But I would daydream, and I would look at the windows, and they used beautiful glass.
How do you decide what sorts of things you're going to create? I mean, is it something that just stirs in you, or is it deliberate? You know, you're walking down the street, and you see something, and you go, I want to create that in glass.
Well, I don't do that so much. What I usually do is I'll sit down with a piece of paper and a pencil and just start drawing. And I can generally turn the drawing into a design, if I'm doing an abstract anyway, turn the drawing into a design that would work with glass, because there's some things you can't do with glass.
Yeah.
And then I'll just say, okay, well, I've got this drawing. This is pretty cool. What do I do with the glass? And that's the hardest part, you know, is finding which glass to use. And that, you know, I play with, like, sometimes I just do sepia colors.
Uh-huh.
And with splashes of color. My work tends to be a little bit darker than a lot of what you see out there. I don't do, like, the sun catcher. It's more...
I think it's very creative. I've looked at some of the sculptures online, and it's really different kind of stuff.
Well, that was another thing that I did, which was I'd see an artifact, like old heat vents.
Oh.
And I, you know, for about 3 or 4 years, I just called myself a hole filler. I would take, you know, I would take like a heat vent and fill each hole with glass. Yeah, you've got to take the copper foil and make sure you get it throughout, you know. Yeah, you know, concave and convex, you know, angles, and then cut the glass accordingly and stick it in there.
Yeah, you know, your sculptures, when I was looking at them, they look very musical. I mean, you've got some kind of a rhythm going with this medium.
I like music.
I have to say, it really does. It looks very mathematical and musical to me.
Yeah, it is it's odd. I've been, since I've been in handwork, which has been about 4 or 5 years, I've been watching the people that come in that like it. I mean, a lot of people like it, but the people that become more intrigued with it, and they're mostly men.
Hmm.
Whether it be some kind of like physics thing, or you know, educated men who are in the field of science.
I can see that. Yeah.
A lot of my pieces get sold to Cornell professors for their way out of, you know, for retirement.
Wow, that is amazing.
Yeah, I've sold many pieces that way.
And you're totally self-taught, right? I mean, did you ever take learn how to blow glass or do any traditional?
No, I never took any art course. I took one drawing course at Cornell.
That's part.
It's
probably
AD.
Better. Oh. It's probably better. I mean,
yeah, I couldn't stand it.
You didn't have to become stained, so to speak, by what they're supposed
to
be.
No, you do it this way. And I said,
yeah, exactly.
Why? You know, it didn't make sense.
You know what I wanted to ask you too? You said your first solo show in 2004, and you sold some pieces, but you discovered your joy was in working, making the art, and not selling or showing.
Mm-hmm.
To tell me about that. So you didn't feel validation? What did you feel?
Well, I mean, I wasn't looking for validation, really. Everybody kept saying, well, now you're validated. I'm going, what does that mean? You know, and mostly I don't, when I sell a piece, I feel a loss. I don't feel as though, oh, boy, I've just made money. Yeah, everybody needs money, and I do, you know, I certainly need money. But it's not, it always leaves me with a feeling of I've done something that's kind of almost a little wrong.
Hmm.
With horses, when I was a kid and I was free with horses, it was totally different from when I became a professional and I accepted money for what I did. It changed the dynamic of my relationship with horses.
And the same thing happened with art, huh?
Well, it hasn't happened with art because I'm not letting it happen with art.
Ah.
I'm kind of... Oh, you like that? You bought it? Good. What's your name? Thank you very much. I'm not happy with it. It doesn't like make my day. I just sold a piece for, you know, like $2,600. And I think I should be ecstatically happy. But I don't have that piece anymore. I have a crummy picture of that piece.
Isn't that interesting? What do you think that is? Do you think that's a female artist thing in some way?
I have
that
no
you feel
idea
like you're
if
like
it's
ripping
gender
people
related
off or something?
Well, I don't know. I don't think it's a matter of, you know, I feel pretty confident that my work is, you know, they're buying it. So
it's beautiful stuff, Lena.
You know, I love it. You know, I love doing it. So anything you really, really love doing, you can't, you know, it's worth it. With at least what that is.
Uh-huh.
So it's not. I don't feel any ripoff stuff going on. It's more. It's this feeling of loss and.
Yeah.
And I don't know where they are. You know, like most of the stuff I sell at Handwork, it goes out the door, and I don't have a name. Most of the time, I find out what city it ends up in. Rarely do they end up in Ithaca?
This is like putting a child up for adoption, isn't it?
Well, it is a little bit.
That's interesting. Has any of your stuff ended up in museums? I would assume that it might.
I don't believe so. I think that they go to private owners, and they go to New York, they go to Boston. I just sold some in D.C. They just go. Ohio is a big one.
They leave
Cleveland.
You.
Yeah, they leave me, and it's, you know, at the first pieces I sold, it just devastated me, because I said, did you get a phone number? Did you get a name? No. Yeah.
Wow.
So they were gone. You know, those pieces are gone. Yeah. My last piece, this giant city piece, it is history. I'll never see it again.
And it feels like a loss.
It's heart-wrenching.
Really, you know, a lot of people who are writers that I've had on have said, you know, once I do the work, it's not mine anymore. It goes out in the world and it belongs to someone else in some ways.
Yeah.
You know, somebody who writes a novel, and then people decide what it is. You don't feel that way about your art, or do you finally let it go? You must.
Well, you have to, or else you'll drive yourself nuts.
Yeah.
But I always miss it. I mean, I really do miss those pieces, like, you know, even these dinky little things that, you know, I thought, okay, well, here's a nice dinky little piece, and it's gone, and I go, and I think about it, and I say, God, that was a nice piece. I wish I could remember all the details.
Yeah.
What colors did I use? What glass did I use? Not to duplicate, but just because I wanted to, you know, I want to see it again. Sometimes with my work, I have to take it. I don't like it when I first hang it up.
Hmm.
I'll look at it and go, whoa, what did I just do? If I can take that and put it away for 6 months, which I can't afford to do, you know, because they take a long time to make, I like it a lot better after I haven't seen it in a long time. Hmm. Like, I went to someone's house the other day. In fact, the woman who told me where to go to learn how to do glass, and I saw two pieces that she has, and I went, holy, how did I do that? Because looking at them, I cannot figure out how I was able to put those drawings together.
That is so interesting. I'm sure a lot of people feel that way. I have felt that way about my work. It's really interesting. Now, we are almost out of time. You do have a studio in Trumansburg.
Yes.
And it's on the art trail.
It's halfway between Ithaca.
You're on the art trail, so people could come see your work. Do you have any exhibits coming up this summer that you can tell people?
No, I haven't felt well enough to do. It's too much.
So nothing's coming up in the near future. What about contact information in case people do want to come visit your studio?
I have a website, and I have a phone, and all of that's on my card.
Just give out your website. I think people would appreciate.
It's just www.linadolph.com.
And that's LINNADOLPH .com.
All lowercase.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure people will be interested, and you are on the art trail, so people have a chance to see your work if they.
Right. The art trail does have its own website for each artist.
Yeah.
It's a really good thing because it's not just those two weekends. It goes throughout the year.
Yeah. Yeah.
And.
Well, people, my guest has been Lynna Dolph, artist, glassworker. I swear, you've got to go out and see her work. It's absolutely beautiful. Lynna, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.